Blog Talk Radio.
Of all the radio shows we have going on. Kicking it off, of course, with today, with three outstanding authors. First up, we're going to have Alan Jacobson. It's always good to have Alan back. Followed by Jeff Abbott and then Lee Adams. So it's sure you have something going on with all of these authors that you can be reading. You know, those New Year resolutions, when you say you want to read more books, here's three people right here that are going to get you on that path. We also want to let you know that all the shows this year are brought to you by Kensington Books. com. Make sure you check out Kensington Books. They are going to be our sponsor for the year. That's right, we got a sponsor. Now it's the big time. So check out KensingtonBooks.com for more information on that. And also Revel Books. Make sure you look at them and see what they have going on. You can visit BakerPublishingGroup.com. That is Irene Hannon, Lisa Harris, and Lynette Eason have books out now, so go check them out. But let's jump in here to our first guest. We've had him on the show several times. He's a great author, great writer. He has his third book out in his, OPSIG Team Black series called The Lost Codex. I'm excited to get into him about this one because he kind of does a lot of history and takes us back to the age of biblical times and things going forward. So, Alan, always a pleasure, my friend. How are you doing? Thanks so much for coming.
I'm doing great. It's a new year, John, and I'm very happy to be back.
Yes. And
on the show.
we were supposed to have you in 2015. Should happen. We messed it all up. But now we got you as the first guest, 2016, kicking off the year, and that's an awesome thing to be able to spend it with you and to talk about your third book in your newest series. It's kind of, I guess you want to say, It's like the spinoff of the Karen Vale series because she's involved, but it's the OPSIG Team Black book, number 3, called The Lost Codex, and you do a little history lesson with this one going back. So why don't you kind of give everybody a little bit of a background maybe of the series itself, and then let's get into the book.
Sure, sounds great. So OPSIG Team Black, it's a covert ops, black ops team that goes on missions usually around the world, but it can be in the U.S. as well. They handle things that can't be disclosed by the United States government, things that could be threatening to our national security. It could be dealing with a rogue leader or a terrorist group, any of the sort of those circumstances. And so OPSIG is involved with handling those things for the U.S., and they do it under the radar. No one knows about them. It's one of those things on the Pentagon budget that is black, you know, so it's a black hole. Nobody knows what's being expended, what it's for, so on and so forth. It's very exciting. The stories are, adrenaline rushes, but there's also a lot of story behind them, and that's where the Lost Codex comes in. Now, The Lost Codex was a book that really there were two main things that spurred me to write this. One was the ancient biblical documents part, which you mentioned. When I was in Israel a few years ago, I saw something. I was looking at the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I saw something on a placard there. And you're not allowed to take photos in the shrine of the book. It's a very temperature-controlled, light-controlled environment, as you can imagine, for such old documents. You know, they're very sensitive to any kind of environmental insults. So I had to read this thing. I'm reading it and going, oh, my God, that's fascinating. I can't believe I never heard about this. And I had to try to remember it all. So, because they said, this is going to be a great book.
But imagine a writer with no pen and paper to write notes down.
Oh, you know, welcome to the 21st century, you know.
Yep.
So I did my best to remember the salient parts of this thing that was formulating in my brain going, oh, my God, I got to write a book about this. And, of course, as in any museum, we were in the Israel Museum, any museum you walk through the gift shop on the way out, and there was a book on it, a small book, but it was enough to stimulate me and remind me, and then I started doing my research on that after. But that was the first thing that got me started, this ancient biblical document that really got me very excited. The second part of it was a course that I took, Chris Kyle, we all know him from the American Sniper. He had a business called I'm blanking on what the business was called, but it was a business that trained Kraft International. So they trained law enforcement officers, military types, and diplomatic protective details on close quarters combat, protection, all those things. And in addition to learning close quarters combat, which was like laboratory work on a shooting range, we also had some classwork time. And I started speaking with one of the main instructor there, who was a former sniper himself in England, and he started telling me and telling us about some things that he saw coming domestically in the United States regarding terrorist groups. And I started, it started percolating in my head because, we've all seen now, of course, more things going on in that regard. But back then, a few years ago, it was not. And I thought to myself, well, gosh, why can't these attacks be happening on American soil? I can't believe it hasn't happened yet. So I took the information that I had gotten from him and I combined it with some information that I had discovered in speaking with my experts, because I do a lot of research for my books with law enforcement agencies of across the globe, and I started musing on this idea, putting together the concept that I had come up with regarding that ancient biblical document, and the story behind the Lost Codex started to take shape, and it was very, very exciting. I couldn't wait to start writing it. While I was outlining it, then I started doing the research, and it got even more interesting. And so I had this book that was just so I was very, very excited about it, but it didn't feel like a traditional Karen Vale novel. Not that any of the Karen Vale novels are traditional, but it did not feel like one that I would build a story around her. And so I said that to my editor, and he said, you know what, Alan, just write the book the way it should be written, and we'll worry about what it is later. So when I finished the book, we sat down, discussed it, and he said, okay, I see what we've got here. And his idea was something, one of those times when it's the answer's in front of your head, in front of your face the whole time, and you don't see it. And then when you see it, it's like, how did I not see that? Well, that's kind of what this was. OBSIG Team Black is the main focus of the Lost Codex. And Karen Vale, as you noted, is in it. She is one of the three main characters that drive everything that happens in that story. But the whole crux of it revolves around OBSIG and this covert operation that they have to undertake because the U.S. homeland is under siege by terrorists. And so we had the obvious part is that OBSIG appears in two other books of mine, going back to my very first book, my second book back in 2001, The Hunted. That's where OBSIG was introduced, and that's where the characters that that we have seen throughout my Karen Vale series, there have been a number of characters that I've introduced. That all came from The Hunted and OBSIG. And then Hard Target, 3 years ago, that also involved OBSIG. And I introduced another character into that universe, Aaron Uzi, the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force head in Washington, D.C. So Uzi, Douglas Knox, the FBI director, Hector DeSantos, the main black ops operative that I have, the Special Forces veteran, those three are the crux of OBSIG that I follow. And we looked at it and we said, well, man, you know, The Hunted is where you introduced OBSIG. That's the first book in the series. Hard Target continues that story. That's the second book in the series. And here we have The Lost Codex, which is the third book in the series. And like I said, it's one of those things when you look at it, you know, you say, how did I not see this? It was there in front of me the whole time. And so it was very exciting for me because I have a lot of stories that I want to tell in the OBSIG universe that are already, you know, written in some form in terms of outlines. And I've got a lot of the Karen Vale stories that I want to tell. So, you know, Karen Vale won't be in every OBSIG Team Black book, but when it makes sense to bring her in, I will. And she has such an incredible rapport with Uzi and DeSantos. It's so fun for me to write all those characters that I get a tremendous kick out of writing these books. So I think it comes through in the writing. There's a lot of humor. There's great banter among the three of them, and just tremendous relationship and depth of character to them.
Yeah, and I mean the trio work very well together, and the action you kind of ramp it up, and it is a little different than a Karen Vale book in the sense because it is a trio and kind of how the interaction goes, but it's not that far off to where fans of Karen Vale jump into this series and it still feels like home. It still doesn't feel out of the way where you have some people, of course, when they write two series, they're so opposite that it almost hurts them in a way because you have one character that does one thing, another one that's totally different than another, and fans really are only going to say, you know what, I don't like this series, but I like this series. But you've done something that is they're parallel, and Karen just kind of can jump back and forth because, let's face it, I mean, you know, she is your character. I mean, she is the one that is driving the driving force behind, you know, your library now.
Yeah, you know, that's a very, very astute observation, John, and I honestly couldn't have said it any better, but that's exactly how I feel, because the style between the two series is very similar, and the characters, as I said, you know, earlier, there are characters that from the OBSIG Team Black universe that are in the Karen Vale universe. So they're mixed and matched. It's not the traditional two separate series with two separate tracks, two separate styles, you know, two different characters. There, as you said, these universes overlap, and it's very approachable for a reader who likes the Karen Vale series to read the OBSIG Team Black, and the same goes, you know, in the reverse. Readers of OBSIG Team Black would feel very, very much at home and comfortable reading the Karen Vale series. I wish I could say I did it all by design, but, you know, sometimes you just let the creative juice happen and, you know, good things come out of it.
Yeah. You know, and that's one of the things, because when you keep writing and you keep inventing and you keep finding new characters and you keep finding new plots and you keep having all these new stories, sometimes this is how these things kind of weave themselves out. And it's not until you have 5-6 books and then you start looking back and you say, wait a second, this is kind of all, you know, working itself together. And then you can start working it all together, I guess, if you want to say. And that's kind of how it comes out. And now you kind of have your clear focus with your OBSIG Team books. Now you have your Karen Vale books. And I think your next book is going to be Karen Vale. But now when you have all these topics in your head, how are you kind of filtering them to make to see who's going to be the lead? That's the fun part now.
That is the fun part, and you're absolutely right that as you start to get a body of work, you can kind of step back and see what you've got, and you see what you've created with these characters. The Lost Codex is my 10th book, which is, wow, 10 books. I mean, you know, when I think back, I remember saying to myself, I want to get to 10 books, you know, in terms of career goals. You know, you start thinking, oh, wow, 10 books would be really cool. Can I do that? I mean, that's a lot of work, 10 books. You know, that's at least 10 years of work, you know, and really more.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And I did it, and I'm very excited. And now, you know, the 11th one, Karen Vale, I'm almost finished with that one. And I've already got, you know, another one that's kind of ready to go. Then another one that I had written and stopped when The Seventh Victim, the first Karen Vale novel, went to contract. I would love to finish that one. My agent loves it, and he says, you got to finish this one. So there's pressure on me to do that because I love that story and different characters. So that would be a standalone. There's one that I want to write involving Robbie Hernandez, Karen Vale's fiancé. He's a DEA agent. There's a great story I want to tell with that. I just, you know, if I had three of me, I could, you know, if I could clone myself,
really?
I'd have enough time to write all these books. But that's a good thing to have, to be so excited. Yeah. You know, I learned a long time ago, John, I decided that if I'm not very excited about a book, I can't write that book. I wouldn't want to write that book because who wants to spend a year doing something that you don't enjoy? Not only that, but the writing would be flat and boring.
Yeah.
And my God, why would I want to, you know, put that out with my name on it? I wouldn't. You know, my reputation means a great deal to me. So if my name is on that book, it's going to be the best freaking thing I can write. So,
yeah.
You know, you asked how I decide, how I filter out and say, okay, this is a Karen Vale, this is going to be an Opsic Team Black. It really emanates from the story and the characters. And let me give you an example. When I wrote Hard Target, I wrote it because it was a book that was a story that emanated from Uzi. As I mentioned, Uzi is the head of the Joint Terrorism Task Force for the FBI in Washington. And it was a story that only could apply to Uzi because things that happened in that story come from who he is as a person, his history, things that happened to him and his family. It could not have been anybody else's story. And back when we sold The Seventh Victim, I had a version of Hard Target already written. And my publisher said to me, we want another Karen Vale. We want to make Karen Vale a series. Because I never intended Karen Vale to be a series. I swore up and down that I would never write a series. And, of course, here I am writing two. But my reasoning was I had seen other authors get stale writing series, where it's basically, after a while, it becomes the same book rewritten in, you know, maybe a different city, but it's the same story and the same characters over and over. And I won't do that. You know, in fact, I said to my publisher, I don't want to do that, and here's why. And he said, well, we want you to think about it because we really want Karen Vale to be a series. And I am so grateful to this day that he, I wouldn't say forced me to do it, but it was, you know, some pretty intense pressure when your publisher tells
you,
we really want you to do this, you know. So I'm so glad that he made me do that because I would not have otherwise written all these books that I just absolutely love. They're like children. I love every single one of them. I'm very proud of them. And I know when I sit down to outline a new story, when I have a story idea, I generally know whose book it is. But as I said, The Lost Codex was kind of this one where I wasn't sure. It didn't feel like a Karen Vale, but Karen Vale felt like part of the story. So I wasn't sure what to do with it. But generally, all the ones that I've outlined henceforth, I know. It's very clear which one Karen Vale is going to be a part of for the Opsic series, which one she's not, which stories are Karen Vale stories and which ones are not. So, you know, generally it's clear. But, you know, in the case of Lost Codex.
I remember because, you know, and it's funny that you mentioned, you know, you didn't want to write a series, but I remember, of course, you and I first connected when you first wrote The Seventh Victim. You know, our magazine and things were kind of new, and we were kind of doing, and we kind of connected, and we talked with you about The Seventh Victim, which is the first in the series now. So we've kind of followed you as you've kind of went up the chain also in all of your writing, and it's great to be able to see now the expansion of how you've done. And I think that's kind of cool for us on our kind of on our side of it to kind of see now how everything is kind of expanded. So it's got to be cool for you.
Oh, it's very cool. You know, as I mentioned, I'm very, very proud of each one of these novels that I've written. And, I mean, that's a great feeling to be able to say that.
Yeah.
And when I wrote Spectrum, which was last year's book, Spectrum went back in time to Karen Vale's beginnings, you know, before The Seventh Victim. Seventh Victim, you know, picks up in the middle of things. She's already an FBI profiler for a few years, and we're off and running with a story. We meet her, and we get acclimated to her brand of humor and sarcasm and who she is as a person. But in Spectrum, I went back before that, you know, to her first day on the job as an NYPD beat cop. And that was a challenge because I had to write her in a way that I had never visited her before, you know, as a rookie, as somebody who is not confident and not experienced. And it was when I first conceived of the idea, I was honestly a little nervous. I was like, can I write this Karen Vale? Because this Karen Vale is different from theoretically, you know, as we all were when we were 22, 23 years old, right? We were different people than we are when we're 40 years or older.
Exactly.
So we're 38 is in Karen Vale's situation. So, but once I started writing it, it was so natural, and it gave me a chance to explore Karen Vale in a way that brought us from the past to the present. And I love that story. It's a great story. And what that's done is, even though I didn't intend it to be this, people have said that it's a great entry into the series, where you could start the Karen Vale series with Spectrum, which was really the sixth book in the series, and then go back and start, you know, with The Seventh Victim. I had never thought of doing that, but my publisher said that's what a lot of people are doing.
That's how it happens. Just like the Star Wars movies. You know, now people are saying you watch episode 4, then 5, then you go 2 and 3, and it's like this weird thing. When people ask me about your books, and they say, where should I start? And I say, well, do you want to start with what I consider the best, or do you want to start at the beginning? Because for me, the best Karen Vale book is Inmate 1577. That's the one that I always tell people, look, if you really want to get a great sense of Alan and then you're going to get locked into his writing, read that book first, and then you can't help but go read all the others because you're so enthralled with that story. But now you've done something in the Lost Codex which kind of foretold some things, I guess, in real life a little bit. Can you kind of go a little bit into that? Because we're kind of running down to the time, and I want to make sure you kind of get that out.
Sure. Fortunate or unfortunate, depending upon how you look at it. But
right.
I saw some trends and patterns, and in speaking with the experts, they kind of confirmed some of the things that I was seeing that were going on. And I just I felt that there was going to be this boiling point that we were going to reach, and a spillover of the violence that we had seen elsewhere in the world, particularly the Middle East. I felt we were going to see it in the United States and Europe. And let me just say that the Lost Codex starts off in Washington, D.C. It goes to New York City. It goes to England, Paris, and Israel. So, you know, if you look at each one of those places, you know, in terms of terror attacks and thwarted terror attacks, every one of those has seen its share of excitement this past year. My story was intended to be fiction, but you know that my fiction, the only thing fictional is are the stories that I tell and the characters that I create to you know, populate those stories. But in this case, even the story started to come true. So, yeah, it was unfortunate. In fact, right after Lost Codex, the day Lost Codex launched was the morning after the Paris attacks, and I had an event in Southern California, and one of the things that I said was, if you want to understand what happened, why the Paris attacks happened, read the Lost Codex. Because
wait a second, you were here in L.A. and you didn't contact me?
It was a quick one-day conference, John.
Oh,
I was
okay.
In and out, but otherwise I would have,
right,
of course.
All right, wait to save face on that one.
That's the truth. You know, I only speak the truth, except when I write my fiction, right? Then I'm kind of lying.
And real quick, again, does it kind of freak you out when that happens? When something like
it
that
does.
Happens?
It does, because it's not the first time it's happened. There have been every single time, it seems, that I write a book. It happened with Velocity, which was the third Karen Vale novel.
Start writing a book about peace, then.
I know. That's what my editor said, you know.
Oh, you do it to us, Alan. I want to give you the last word to let you can kind of let everybody know how they can get in touch with you, your social media, you know, website, of course, is alanjacobson.com. But kind of let everybody know in this last minute where you're at and what you're doing so people can get in touch with you.
So I'm on Facebook, facebook.com/AlanJacobsonFans. My website, which is alanjacobson.com, alanjacobson.com. I'm on Instagram, alan.jacobson, spelled the same way, of course. Twitter, @JacobsonAlan. And I think that probably covers
That's about it.
I am active on social media. You can contact me by email through my website as well. We've got a newsletter that if you sign up for the newsletter, you get a free ebook on personal safety that I co-wrote with the FBI profiler that I've worked with for 23 years now.
Awesome.
That's definitely a worthwhile book. So, yeah, there's a lot of ways to contact me. My website is the crux of everything.
All right, Alan. Hey, we got to get you on earlier because there's some topics I'd like to talk to you about, maybe outside the books and things, and I think you'd be a good person. So I'm going to email you and get with you and see if you have time, and we can kind of talk about some things.
I always make time for you, John.
All right, Alan. You have a good one. It's a pleasure. Good luck, and we'll talk with you soon.
Thanks, everyone, for listening.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So again, everybody, that is Alan Jacobson, and his book is The Lost Codex. Make sure you go check it out. I'll tell you, it's one of his best. And like he said, he kind of foretold some things, so make sure you go check that out. Also want to go to darkrenaissance.com, and if you like ghost stories and things that are a little on the shadow and the occult and those kind of realms, Dark Renaissance is a place that you want to go hit and check them out. Of course, again, we are sponsored here by KensingtonBooks.com. Make sure you go check them out. Another great friend of ours, Kim Harrison, she's the best-selling author of the Hollow series. Her latest book, The Drafter, is something a little bit outside of this realm, and it is an outstanding book to just show the depth of author that Kim is. You will not be disappointed when you check that out. So make sure you check out Kim Harrison and The Drafter, and I think that you will find that fascinating. We're going to take a short break. We're going to be back with our next guest. His latest book, The First Order, just hit. It's the fifth in his Sam Capra series. It's Jeff Abbott. We're excited to speak with him. So in the meantime, why don't you just take a little listen to this?
Welcome to the world of make-believe.
So welcome back, everybody, after the break. Again, we want to thank Alan Jacobson for being on, great friend of ours. It's always great to have Alan on the show. Now, I messed up. I looked at the wrong name, and I saw Jeff will be on after. This is our next guest. She is her name is Lee Adams. She wrote her first book in her newest. It's a Kate Ford mystery series called Hostile Witness, and it's by Crooked Lane Books, a newer publisher that we just got turned on to, and they put out some very exciting stuff, and you can check them out by going to crookedlanebooks.com. But we want to welcome Lee to the show. So, Lee, thanks so much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, and I'm really happy with this book.
That's a good thing. So let's just jump right into it here. You know, let's just go. Hostile Witness, it's the first in a new series, Kate Ford Mystery Series, out by Crooked Lane Books. So why don't you go ahead and give us the skinny about what you got going on here?
Okay, in first place, yes, it's technically mysteries because we're all in the Mystery Writers of America. But it's closer to a thriller kind of series.
Okay.
It focuses a lot on really being active in an investigation rather than sitting there and just thinking with your little gray cell, if that makes sense.
Gotcha. Well, the little gray cell, now you're saying mystery, a little bit Hercule Poirot on that one, so people are going to understand that.
Yes. It's less Hercule Poirot than it is like a Die Hard movie. I mean, not quite. You know,
yeah.
I have my son in the room, and he's laughing when I say like a Die Hard movie. But it is a thriller-based, it is an action-based series. And it's also largely a, I don't want to say political, but involved with government and institutions because it takes place in Washington, D.C. So you have to worry about classified information and various agencies like the CIA and lobbyists and all that sort of thing. And she gets involved with it because she gets fired.
Mm.
She works for a security company, a company that provides security for corporations and to an extent for the government. And I don't know how many of your readers know this, but there is like an entire separate internet for government information. And you can't even be on a computer accessing that system and accessing Internet Explorer. And
I've never heard of that. I have to. How did you stumble upon that?
The gentleman I see was until very recently employed by one of those agencies.
There it is. Okay.
I don't think most people do know that, but they're very, very, very careful to try to keep that separate, to try to keep it hard to hack, you know, the nuclear code.
Right.
And she accidentally breaches that. And the first thing they do is throw her out, which they should.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to figure out how it came about that she ended up breaching something she's not intending to breach, she stumbled on all the rest of this. And I think that's the plot.
And so Kate Ford, as a person, if she were kind of to be here with us, because she's a single mom, but then she's involved in more of a high tech job. So she kind of has to wear two hats. I mean, that's kind of a two hat kind of thing. How would you kind of describe her to someone who's just getting her for the first time outside of the plot area? But just who is Kate Ford? You know, how would she kind of handle certain situations? Because she's very much in this book a normal person put into an extraordinary situation, something that she's so not familiar with, and that had to be kind of a mystery to you also. How would she kind of handle, so when she was speaking to you and you were writing the book, how did you kind of handle all of that that she was trying to tell you?
Well, being a single mother, all right, wasn't a mystery to me. I was widowed very, very young with two very young children, much younger than Kate. So that part, I've got that part taken. I mean, I know how that works. I think that she's a person who very much feels as if she has to be perfect at everything. and who really isn't. She has a disability. It's an odd neurological disability, and it doesn't show on the surface, so people think everything is hunky-dory all the time when it's not. And, yeah, she juggles all that all the time. She is really committed both to her son and to her father, who has the beginnings of and rapidly deteriorating Alzheimer's disease. Again, I started my own movie a lot. My mother had very bad dementia before she died. So trying to put it, when you're in the middle of a situation like that, you've got all the little juggler things in the air and you're really not paying attention to how you're doing it, just not to failing. Not failing?
Gotcha.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, so what was, you know, kind of, since you had a lot of background that you were already working with personally, what was one of your biggest challenges when writing the book with her and with the whole series that, you know, that is now, you know, going to be a series? So kind of, what was kind of your biggest challenges, you know, with the book, Hostile Witness?
Well, first place, I have done other things, and they have been much more the Poirot sort of thing. So this was a real departure for me. I meant it to be. I meant it to be me trying to do something totally new. So first it was, okay, how do you handle a thriller plot when I can't let him sit down and work out things on a piece of paper? And that was difficult. One of the things I have to give Crooked Lane Books is they have wonderful editors, and they are really committed to it. So that they would help me all along the way. I'd send this thing in and go, I don't know what it says anymore. Come back with, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4. So it was, the new kind of plot was very, very unusual for me to do.
Okay.
With Kate herself, the big problem is always not to let that disability overwhelm everything else. We had a lot of discussions about what should or shouldn't trigger an attack. And in the end, we cut back what triggered an attack a lot, and I think that was the right decision. So the disability is there, but it doesn't define her or completely overwhelm her.
Gotcha. Okay. And so when you decided that you wanted to jump into this realm of, you know, like you said, kind of more of a thriller, you know, with some mystery aspects and things like that, what was it for you that pulled you in to write in this genre? Because like you mentioned, you've done other things before, but what was it, you know, what was your pull for this one? Why did you decide that now was the right time to kind of bring out this new, you know, this series and start writing this?
Well, you know, for one thing, my gentleman friend, all right, has told me things that I think most people don't know, all right, which I found completely fascinating. The entire way that the internet works for the government, especially for any part of the government involved in security, like stuff in Afghanistan or stuff, all right. So there was that, and then there was also with the other stuff I was doing. I was just feeling stale, and I wanted something that was fun, that would be fun to write and fun to read without it getting tangled up in issues and serious and sad, which seems to be all that's going on at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, the core, what it turns on is how those two separate internets interact or shouldn't. And that still fascinates the hell out of me.
So now that you've kind of are through it, you know, what was kind of the process, the journey? A lot of authors, a lot of young authors or inspiring authors always listen to the show because they always like to hear the journey. They like to know how you were able to go from writing the first word of your book to now being published and now getting it out there. So how was that journey for you going through to now finally seeing it published and now you're talking about it?
Well, in the first place, Crooked Lane editors and I went back and forth before I ever started reading anything about the essentials of what was going to be in the book and what wasn't, which wasn't actually exactly what showed up by the end, but at least we talked about it. before I started in. And what I always do, and I didn't change that for this, is that I sit down and I write a first draft as fast as I can do it.
Mm-hmm.
As fast, like, don't think, just do it. For one thing, I think if I didn't do that, I could never, ever write a book because I'd never get done. If I started thinking it through at the beginning, I'd freeze myself. So I wrote a first draft, and it was like 900 pages long, and everybody talked in soft little tones so that nobody freaked out writing them. And then we started cutting it. You know, I would cut a bunch of it. I would send it in. They would cut a bunch of it. Send it back. We go back and forth. There's now this new thing you can do on some word processing programs where everybody's changes are marked in different colors. Okay,
mm-hmm.
By the end of the fifth round of that, I had no idea what anything said. So we cleaned it up and started again. But that's it. I write everything that's in my head, and then I throw out. And there's a lot to throw out because I tend to get very detailed in the way I think inside a character's head.
Okay.
So I know
and
a lot
so,
about Kate. Nobody else does.
And so what character in the book of Hostile Witness, and again, I want to remind everybody, we're speaking here with author Lee Adams, and the latest book in the book in that we're talking about is called Hostile Witness, first book now in a Kate Ford mystery that's going to be a series. So who would be your surprise character that when you first started down to start writing it, you had no idea they would kind of be that big of a voice, and they kind of jumped out at you in being a much bigger voice than they were in the book?
Kate's boss, not her immediate boss, but the person who heads the corporation that owns the company she gets fired from. And I had a very straightforward idea of who he ought to be when I started. Everybody had a very straightforward idea of who he ought to be when he started, and he turned out to be much more complex than that. And I'm kind of proud of myself because there was a certain tendency to write books and do television and movies these days that is essentially the good guys versus the capital evil, capital corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And this made it not so straightforward. And I'm glad. Like I said, he's, I think, a very interesting person.
And do you see his role expanding as you kind of go forward? Do you have that kind of plan? Did plans change after the writing of this book for the second one and maybe so on and so forth going forward now with the series?
Well, I don't know about the second one yet. All right.
Okay.
But by the time I was finishing the book, yes, I very much want a way to get him into further volumes if I can.
So now, the other thing that we always like to get into with an author that's kind of new into the genre is, you know, were there any authors that you worked with or that you read that kind of got you excited about writing, into this series or into this genre?
Oh, I read everybody.
Who's like your favorite?
I'm
curious. Who's somebody that you love to go to that maybe got you excited to kind of say, you know what, I can do this, and this is what I kind of want to do?
Oh, do you know a writer named Brendan Dubois?
I do not know that.
D-U-B-O-I-S.
I do not know that author.
Okay, well, you should know this author, and you should call him. Because he has a book up recently, and he's going to be working with James Patterson for the next James Patterson book. But his name is Brendan Dubois, and he was a good friend of my late husband's. And, yeah, there's just – he does stuff like this. Also, Gail Wins.
Oh, yeah. Gail's great.
Yeah. So I had things around. I like to read this kind of thing. I just never tried writing it before.
Did you attend conferences before you started to get involved in it? Did you do anything like that? Any writing groups? Any kind of book clubs and things like that that kind of got you, feet wet at the beginning?
Well, my feet have been sort of wet for several years, but in the last 3 to 5 years, there have been all kinds of things happening at my house, and I haven't been to a convention now for I think a good 5 years. But I live way out in the country, and it was hard to do with the situation as it was here.
Yeah, it, also, I mean, it makes it different when you're kind of out and about and not really close to things.
Yeah, I'm not close to anything. I have deer. No, I have deer. I have squirrels. I have wild turkeys. You know? I mean, I don't own them. They invade me. Yeah.
Right. And they, yeah, they kind of come in and say, this was our land first, but we're happy you're here. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, if we could find a way to do something about wild turkeys in a book, that might be interesting, but I really hate wild turkeys. Yeah,
well, that would, with what you're writing in now, that would kind of be a little difficult. Unless you wanted to go cozy and you wanted to have maybe wild turkeys as part of your cozy book, then that might fit maybe somebody in the Green Mountains up there in Vermont or where you're at in the Northeast. You know, then that could be, you just never know what goes on in those areas, because there's a lot of stories that when you look out your back door, you could probably, you know, just find and incorporate little things like that into the series and give it that small town feel, kind of with that, you know, that big, you know, that big massive plot that you have going on. And it's kind of a nice little, I guess you want to say for the reader, a nice little difference when you see it in the book. They kind of complement themselves well.
I don't like what gets called cozy these days, because it's too cute.
It's a broad stroke. Yeah, it is a broad stroke.
But there are other things besides thrillers. I mean, you have, like Peter Diamond and the other series that are not thrillers, but they're not cute. I guess I feel there's a lot of violence in these books. I wouldn't say it was graphic. There's a lot of violence in any mystery just because there's a murder. I mean, someone's
right.
Dead, so therefore there has to have been violence. And I get weirded out by the idea of being cute around corpses. I am probably making no sense.
No. I mean, I understand. I mean, there's some people that, you know, when I, because Law and Order, because Murder, She Wrote is one of my favorite shows. And so I understand, you know, typically with Murder, She Wrote, the murder is, there's always a murder, but it's pretty bland. There's not a lot of gore or anything that goes with it. It's just somebody dies in some kind of a way, but that doesn't really show. But the cozy part, I guess, is the cuteness of somebody who's not a detective being thrown into a situation that now they're an amateur detective. And it's not so over the top. There's really not, you know, a lot of that stuff going on. It's kind of like Murder by Death, which was a great play by Neil Simon. And it was a cute little play, even though, you know, the murder and everything was all wrapped in it. It was just cute and funny and comedic, and it made it fun. And that's, I think that's more of the definition of the genre. But now I think that they're taking liberties to call things cozy because they know that it's a big-selling genre right now. I mean, cozies are really big.
Oh, I did not know that.
Mm-hmm.
Is Murder by Death, did they make a movie of that with...
they did, with Peter Falk and Truman Capote.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a great movie, one of my favorite plays that, you know, actually became a movie because it was a play first. Yeah, and that was kind of the beginning that I was, like, you know, of, like, the cozy mystery, because it was fun and comedic, and it was just hilarious. But it wasn't violent at all, even though violence was surrounding the whole thing, and I think that that's, you know, I think that that's cool. But you've kind of, you know, written yourself here with Hostile Witness into a character that, like I said, is a single mom, has to deal with things outside of what she's doing and involved in, you know, this other kind of situation. So down the road, how do you kind of see expanding, you know, her role? Have you thought about anything like that yet?
Sure. One of the things that's possible to do with this would be to, remember, she's out of a job by the end of the book. She's on her own, and she has to make a living. And she is an expert in computer security. There's no reason why she shouldn't go to work for a large private detective agency or a government investigation, investigating agency. I mean, she has a skill set that would make it possible for her to actually pick up a franchise without having to be an amateur.
Because
I always got a little, I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, and so you've already kind of changed her in the book, which is kind of a good thing, because now you have so many different roads you can go with this. And I think that's exciting for you to have to sit down and figure that out.
Well, new series are always exciting because you don't know where they're going to go, and it's the people who go there. It's not really the plot. So by the end of this book, she has a love interest, sort of. And she still has all the problems she had, and by the beginning of next book, she's going to have to find some place to work. Don't know where that's going to be yet.
And that's the fun part of the challenge, to have to figure all that out, because the reader will know, you don't even know yet, so it's kind of, and like I said, it's kind of the mystery for both of us, you and I, and the fans, to kind of understand what you're going to do. And that makes it interesting.
Yeah, I hope the people are interesting. You can't write a thriller or a mystery without a villain, which means part of the time the reader is just stuck reading about somebody he doesn't like, or at least he shouldn't like, you know. So you always worry about where the characters are going with the audience.
Mm-hmm. And now that the book, the book comes out in February, the actual release date is February the 9th, and that's when people can get it. So we're about a month ahead of when people are going to be able to pick this up. So now that you're kind of out and talking about it.
You can pre-order on Amazon, what?
Right, yeah, you can pre-order with Amazon. It's available right now to pre-order it February 9th. You wake up in the morning and bam, it'll be right into your Kindle or your hardcover will be at your door.
Land on your porch. They're really good. Yeah.
That's right. So now, like I said, what was my thought I was going to do? So now that you're out kind of talking about it and you're kind of seeing some of the early reviews come in and you haven't really seen the fans anything yet, how does that kind of work on your nerves? To kind of wonder, how are people really going to accept when it gets out there and then people start buying and you start hearing it? You know, do you think about that, or are you just, like, not focused on it and you're just going to be like, you know what, I'm not even going to focus on it, I'm just going to worry about the next book?
You really can't do that if you want to keep working. You really can't. For one thing, only two kinds of people send you any kind of response, people who love it and people who hate it. And the people who hate it send more. Doesn't matter what you do, and they will hate it for weird reasons that you don't know what to do with. I had a book once where my heroine rescued a little cat, and in order to carry her around in New York City, she put this little cat in their enormous bag that she carried everywhere. And I got people sending, "You are a terrible person. That's animal abuse." I'm going, "Well, you know, okay." Leaving it in the street would probably have been, you know, you don't know what to do. You don't know what to do with those things. So I just try to write them and let them take care of themselves.
Well, we got about a minute left. And what I want to do is I want to kind of give you the last word to kind of let everybody know where they can find you, your social media, and things like that. So I will leave it up to you to kind of get all that word out there.
Okay. I think people should go to crookedbooks.com, and they have a Facebook page and a website, and I'm a little not on social media yet.
But you're getting there.
Oh, huh?
But you're going to be getting there.
Yes, I'm getting there. I am. I'm entering the 21st century eventually.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you, Lee, we want to thank you so much for coming on. Congratulations. It's great to see. Crooked Lane Books is definitely we're getting a lot of emails and responses from them. So it's good to see these up-and-coming publishers now coming out and expanding our world because there's so many stories to tell. And, you know, I love to see it. So congratulations and good luck. And can't wait to see, you know, the response. And the book comes out again on February the 9th. But you can pre-order it now. So, again, thank you for coming on.
Barnes & Noble, too, not just Amazon. Anyway, thank
That's
you.
True,
and
even though I don't like Barnes
me.
& Noble, and people know that. But I always say go to Amazon. Shop at Amazon. That's what I always tell people. But that's just me. But, yeah, you can go Barnes & Noble if you truly like to do that. So, all right. Thank you so much, Lee, and enjoy, and we will talk with you later.
Yes, thank you.
Bye. So, again, everybody, that is author Lee Adams. The book is called Hostile Witness. You can go to crookedlanebooks.com for more information on her and the series and everything that Crooked Lane Books has to come out. Like we said, they are a new publisher, and so we want to make sure that, you know, we support all that we can for new publishers and new authors coming up. The other thing we want to say is if you missed our December issue, which is our best of issue, it's our biggest one, we want to congratulate the winner of the 2015 Crimson Scribe Award, which is the highest award that we can give as a magazine. It goes out to one book a year, regardless of the genre or the categories that we have in there. And this year it is Kelly Armstrong with her book Deceptions. Kelly's been writing for quite some time, and Deceptions has won the award this year as the Crimson Scribe Award winner. Again, regardless of the category, whatever, that is the top book that we say of the year. So congratulations to Kelly and her book, Deceptions. Also, if you wanted a copy of it, you can check it out. We're on Facebook. You can email us at editor@suspensemagazine.com. We'll send you over the December issue so you can, you know, see all of the winners and everybody that made it, and you can check them out. We have the list was big this year. Plus, we had Patricia Cornwell, we had Linda Fairstein, and we had some other great interviews within the magazine, so it was jam-packed this year. We are going to take another short break, and then we're going to be back with our next guest, Jeff Abbott, and his book, The First Order. So stay tuned for that. Thank you. again after the break. It's been a great show to kick off the year 2016 here on Suspense Radio Inside Edition. Want to thank Alan Jacobson for being on first, followed by, of course, Lust by Lee Adams. And now it's great to be able to have this next author back. We talked to him with his first book in the series, Adrenaline, and this is now the fifth in his Sam Capra series. It is called The First Order. The book just came out January the 5th, so it's out now on all formats, wherever you buy books. Of course, like we always say, we like people to go to Amazon to buy stuff, but that's perfectly up to you, whatever you want to do it. We want to welcome Mr. Jeff Abbott back to the show. So, Jeff, thanks so much for coming on. How you doing?
I'm doing great today, John. Thank you for having me back on. It's always great to talk to you.
Yeah, Jeff Ayers, of course, we do our show Beyond the Cover. He was a little upset that I didn't have you on for Monday night, and I said, you know what, I got to have some things for myself, Jeff. You're going to have to just wait. You know, we got other people to go on there. So it's great to be able to have you talk. And now book five in the series coming back. So to see you going from Adrenaline now up to this next book, The First Order, you've had yourself quite a journey. So kind of let everybody know about The First Order and maybe kind of give them a little bit of background of how it kind of got to this point, I guess, with Sam.
Adrenaline, you know, like you mentioned, the first one had set sort of Sam's life in motion. He had believed that his brother was murdered in an extremist video working as a relief worker in Afghanistan. And in The Fifth Order, he finds evidence that his brother might still be alive and might have taken on a job assassinating the president of Russia while on a state visit to the U.S. So that's the book in one sentence. It's both an assassination thriller and a family novel, which you don't usually expect. But I have the book is you know, Sam is a former CIA agent, and he's got to use his skills to try to stop an assassination he can tell no one about, because anyone who's told about it, they would try to take down his brother, and he wants to find out why his brother has let all of them believe that he was dead for the past 6 years. So it is very much a novel of sibling rivalry and reconciliation, and, you know, what was this family like that produced both Sam as a former CIA agent and his brother, who apparently made this choice to conceal his death. And I had a blast writing it. That sounds terrible, but I did. I had a blast writing the book.
You know, hey, you got to throw yourself into your work. I mean, I know that death and dismay and all those things, sadness, are all bad emotions. But with thrillers, they're great emotions, because that's kind of what you need to kind of fuel the character going. And would you say that, you know, because of what Sam had to go through in this book, that this is one of your most emotionally charged books that Sam has to go through internally out there?
He's been through a lot of emotionally wrenching stuff in the series, but definitely I think so. There was a lady at the signing in Houston who very kindly sat on the front row because she wanted to be sure to be called on when I opened my talk to Q&A. And she said, "This is your most emotionally complicated book." And she had read them all. And I think it's true. I think part of the reasoning is, you know, Sam chose to become a CIA agent and even before the series had begun, because he wanted to do something about, you know, fighting against the people who had caused his brother's death. And, you know, that's a very noble calling. So he made this very difficult choice, and he entered this very dangerous job because his brother had been killed this way. And when you find out that that is a lie, it sort of makes you question everything that you've chosen in your life. But also he has to both stop his brother from committing an assassination that would absolutely roil the world. You can imagine if the president of Russia was killed on American soil, what that would do. But also he has to save his brother. So he has to stop his brother. He has to save his brother. Writing this book was almost exhausting. You know, it's not like ditch digging or brain surgery, but I would write each day and I would just be like, wow, oh man, this book is getting to me a little bit. So it was a great experience to do it. I think I got to explore a lot about family, but I also got to explore a lot about what the current, you know, political situation is in Russia, and I fictionalized it thoroughly, but there were elements from reality that I borrowed as I was building these two stories in parallel.
Now, of course, you have such an extensive library of books. I mean, this isn't your only series. I mean, you have some standalones. You have a couple other series that you had done, and you have a lot of other books that you had written. So, when you go into a new book like this, and the book The First Order, do you kind of set yourself maybe a goal to say, I'm going to challenge myself in this way to kind of see if I can do something a little different than what I've done before? Does that ever go through your mind, or do you not even really think about it, and maybe it just happens to be that way when you're done that you see that you did something different?
Sometimes I actually do think about it. There have been things that I've done in the books and in the standalones where I'm exploring a character's background, or I sort of feel like I've set a technical challenge for myself. And I think with The First Order, the technical challenge was, how do I get Sam into this group of people, this inner circle that is surrounding the Russian president, because this is his plan. He's going to go undercover and find the person who's paying his brother $20 million. You know, you think it would narrow down the suspects, not when everyone is a billionaire. And into almost like the closed circle of people you would find in a Christie novel or a Sayers novel or a Rex Stout novel, you know, a more traditional mystery, this closed circle of suspects. And so I thought, you know, how can I incorporate that into something that I hope will be a thriller with, you know, high octane action and well pacing, you know, strong pacing, well pacing. What was that? I need more coffee. With strong pacing. You know, so a little bit of blending of styles even. And while all keeping it about the emotional connection between these two brothers, but without sinking into sentimentality or spending, you know, dragging the story down, keeping the story moving. So I think every book is a challenge. It's never felt easy, but there are times with certain books I'm aware that I am setting a little more of a technical challenge for myself. And that keeps it interesting for me, and hopefully that will keep it interesting for readers too.
And now that the book has been out, and this is the ninth, so it's been out just this week. It just kind of came out. And, of course, with social media and everything being so instantaneous, have you been able to see some of that fan reaction? Have you seen things that, you know, that they've said and maybe things that have surprised you that they've said about the book that you didn't realize that maybe they would be passionate about that part of the area? What have you seen?
Well, there's two things worth talking about on that. The first one is, The funniest question that I have been getting is, did I know before the book came out that the First Order was an element of the story in the new Star Wars movie? Because it has the same title, right? And the First Order are the bad guys in the Star Wars movie. The answer to that is no. We had picked the title ages ago. And then probably about 4 months ago, a friend of mine who works in the entertainment business said, hey, did you know in the new Star Wars movie, the First Order is a thing? And I'm like, what kind of thing is it? And he's like, well, I don't really know, but it's supposedly in the script. You know, there were like, you know, little leaks or things that were happening about what the story might involve, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, no. Because I thought, well, this could either be great because I'll get some sales because people accidentally think it's a Star Wars novel. And I love Star Wars, right? I said, but then I'll get angry emails from people that said, I thought I was getting a Star Wars novel. And, of course, one of my friends, the cover of the book in the U.S. is Sam in a long coat with a gun in his hand walking toward the Kremlin. And one of my friends took the gun out of Sam, took the book cover, erased the gun, and put in Kylo Ren's red lightsaber with the red glowing guard in the place of the gun. And it's hilarious. And even his cape looks, now even Sam's coat looks like Kylo Ren's cape. And we posted this as a joke on social media, and it got a lot of likes and a lot of comments. Then, of course, somebody else reposted, a couple of people reposted it, think it's like, this was the real cover of the book. And I'm like, oh, no, okay. So, well, that's something's going to happen. So I'm bound to get an upset email from someone who thinks they are getting, you know, the book on how the First Order was founded before The Force Awakens. So that's been funny.
It's funny because I actually, when I saw, you know, when I saw the name of the book and I'd seen the movie, I didn't know anything about the – I tried not to read anything about the movie because I didn't know how much of it was rumor, and I didn't want to have to get caught up in that. But then when I saw it, I saw your name in the book, The First Order, I was like, well, that's kind of coincidental. But, I mean, I did think of it, but I knew it had nothing to do with Star Wars. I was like, well, that's kind of coincidental. But, yeah, these things are set so far in advance because you have to do press and you have to do book covers and all these things that, I mean, I don't know. I think people think that since everything is so instant that you literally are piggybacking on Star Wars. Like, yeah, no, this was done 8 months ago.
Yeah, it was. And we went through a whole bunch of titles, too, which is really funny. But, you know, Lee Child said once on a panel, coincidences actually do happen, because he'd been criticized because he had, a coincidence happen in one of the books. That was perfectly plausible. And he's right. Coincidences happen. And this is one. But whenever I get the first angry Star Wars email, I'm going to print that out and frame that, because that'll just be too great. One thing I have noticed on this book is that I don't know, because my last novel, Inside Man, ended with a cliffhanger that sort of suggested what the whole plot of, or what the his brother was going to be a huge part of the First Order. So I actually have had people come to the signings who got the book on their e-readers on Tuesday and yet are coming to the signing and buying a signed, you know, print copy, but they could not wait to read the book, and they're halfway through the book already reading it on the e-reader. But they're still coming to the signing and getting a signed copy, which I deeply appreciate. But that is just interesting, because people are like, oh, I already read the book. And I was like, really? And they're like, oh, yeah, I arrived on my e-reader at midnight. And I had one reader who emailed me, and she said, I am taking Tuesday off from work so I can read the book. And I was like, that is the nicest compliment. And then I was filled with terror. What if she doesn't like it? She waits for the vacation day. Oh, no. You know.
Yeah, she's going to write to you and say, okay, you have to pay me for the day of work I missed. I didn't like it.
Yes. I was like, oh, no, I hope she likes it. I feel so lucky because readers are willing to give me their time and their attention, which is a priceless thing, and that people were that excited to see what was going to happen with Sam and his brother. You know, that's the kind of emotional investment you hope readers will have in a series. And so I'm always super grateful to them for that.
Now, of course, have you ever thought about, and I'm sure that fans that have followed you from the beginning, and you probably get this a lot, have you ever thought about going back and revisiting some of the, you know, some of the older series and things that you have written, or turning maybe a standalone, or maybe, you know, sequeling things? Have you ever thought about that, or is Sam just the first and foremost now that you're focusing on your writing now into the future?
Well, I have, and, you know, I had done the Whit Mosley series in the early 2000s, and those three books had gotten two Edgar nominations, and those had sold overseas and had done well, and I stopped writing those because then I got the idea for Panic, which was a standalone, and it did very, very well overseas, and that kind of, you know, redefined my career a little bit. But Grand Central, who is the publisher of the Sand books, has acquired all the old Whit Mosleys and my old standalones and brought them out in new editions. So if I want to write another Whit Mosley and Claudia Salazar novel, I think that would be an easier thing to do because my current publisher has the backlist. You know, sometimes it's a practical decision like that. And I would definitely consider, you know, doing a new one in that series when I have the right idea for it. It's been, you know, 10 years since those books came out, so I'd have to acknowledge, I think, the gap in time with the characters. But again, you know, when you ask about technical challenges, that would be a great technical challenge for me. That's the kind of stuff that I love to do. So,
as an author, you have to keep yourself fresh, not just with your stories and your stuff, but just, you know, as a way for you to expand upon the craft that you've done. I mean, an artist can't keep doing, you know, the Mona Lisa and over and over and over. It's got to be something different and different, and you have to challenge yourself, and I think that's important.
I think it's important. I think it's a balance, because readers have an expectation of what they're going to get when they pick up, you know, a novel by Lee Child or Elizabeth George or any of the other, you know, Michael Connelly. You can think of any number of hugely successful series that people read. But they also want to, you know, keep the reader in their comfort zone yet bring something new to the story. And I think that's the balancing act that you have to do. You don't want to, you know, pick up a novel in a beloved series and feel like it just went off on some incredibly weird tangent that makes it feel like it wasn't ever part of the series. It has to be something organic that's, I think, moving forward. I think that's also one of the challenges that you said for yourself when you're doing a series, or even if you are doing a standalone, it still has to feel like a novel that fits in your wheelhouse and that your readers will appreciate.
And I want to remind everybody that we're speaking here with New York Times bestselling author Jeff Abbott and his latest book, The First Order. No, it's not Star Wars. It's the latest in a Sam Capra series. You can go to jeffabbott.com for more information on that and all the books that you have out now. So going forward, you know, with the series, do you already have the idea of what you're going to do? I mean, or is it going to be something that's totally different? Are you going to jump the rails and go off, or do you already know what's going to happen?
Well, the next book that I'm writing is a standalone. And it's going to be a suspense novel set entirely in Austin, where I live. So it's not going to be globetrotting the way that the Sam books tend to be. But I am going to write the next Sam novel right after that. And I've made really good progress on the standalone. I have three different ideas for what the next Sam novel should be, and I'm just going to have to pick and choose. But that's
right.
A good thing. I feel like so much happened in the First Order that sort of answered some long questions that had run through the series, but then opened up new dramatic possibilities for new situations for Sam, new characters he can encounter. And so I felt there's still so much story to be told with him and with Mila and the supporting cast that he has. So I'm excited.
And now, when you decided that you were going to do this standalone, was this just because you had a story that you had to get out and it wasn't going to fit within any series? It was something just totally different?
Yes, it wouldn't have fit in with a series. It will definitely feel like a Jeff Abbott novel. But it was also one of those ideas that when I told my American and British publisher about it, they were like, yes, 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 which is what you want to hear. But it was a business decision to say, you know, in the next, because in the contract, the next book was going to be the next Sam Capra, but they liked this idea so much, they said, well, let's do this, and, you know, and then write the next Sam afterwards, so.
And you said something interesting, too, when you just were mentioning the First Order. You said that it answered some questions that you kind of had going out throughout the series. So when people are just finding out about the series and maybe at these book signings, and then they're like, so who are you and what you got going on? Of course, where do you tell them that they should probably start with the series? Can they pick up their First Order? Can they go back? What do you recommend?
I tell them start wherever they want, because I've heard from readers who start at the beginning, in the middle, with the newest book. If there is something they need to know, I always try to very succinctly sum it up so they're not lost. But, you know, it is a continuing series, and some people are religious about starting at the beginning of a series and moving forward. Others don't care. I did recently get a review that said you can jump in anywhere with these, and they said, so go for it. Don't, you know, don't feel like you have to go back to the beginning if you don't want to. But I do try to structure it so that you can start anywhere.
And
I
the
personally,
other big thing,
I tend to go back and read at the beginning of a series, but that's just me. For my own reading choices, I like to see how the author develops it over time. But that's just my personal bias on reading.
Now, the other thing that's also become very popular with people writing series, and you did this back in 2012, that you kind of did, you did Sam Capra's Last Chance, which you like to call it like a 1.5. And it was an ebook, and it was a short story, and it was a bridge. But I see a lot of people doing bridges now. They're kind of bringing these things out to kind of bridge from one book to the next. Do you have anything like that coming up in mind that maybe you're going to jump forward maybe like 2 years into the series and then maybe write like a bridge, something that's short to kind of get people there?
Yeah, I mean, we have so many interesting ways to deliver content to readers now. You know, and Sam Capra's Last Chance was e-reader only, and so you could read it on your phone or your computer or your e-reader. And if you don't have, I mean, you can still read it even if you don't have an e-reader. You can read it on most phones or on computers. Yeah. So I had a number of people asking me where they could buy it in print, and I was like, no, it's a short story. It's not going to be in print. But it was funny. It really kind of took off a little bit. It ended up getting published in Britain. It was something I did for my American publisher. It got published in France. You know, and I think it's just sometimes it's fun for readers. It's like a deleted scene on a DVD almost. It is an extra fun thing that they don't have to read to enjoy the books, but it gives them more of the characters that they're interested in. And it, you know, might give a little more depth to explaining a situation in another book. So, yeah, I definitely have thought of doing more of those. I think it just has to be the right bridge so that it's, you know, something that's actually interesting to readers and not just me throwing something out there.
Yeah, and I think that's, and again, that's what you mentioned the balance. That's the balance that has to come out, that you want to make it to where it is a good story and it is something that is kind of maybe a plot that's not big enough to be a book, but it's a good bridge to kind of go back and forth, and it lends more depth to the series. So you may be putting something in there that's a little bit out of the ordinary that you really wouldn't put in the book, and it just gives a little bit more depth.
No, yeah. I think that's a really great way to look at it, John.
Yeah. And so, you know, we're always excited, you know, when we see kind of new things come out. How are you still? Because since you've written so many books, I mean, you know, do you still get excited on launch day that just happened, you know, 4 days ago? Or are you just are so into the next stuff? Once you're finally done with it, you're like, oh, I'm so done with that book. I'm going on to the next one.
Well, I'm trying to get writing on the next one done even during the launch. During the launch days. No, it's always exciting to have a book out. I've never, ever taken it for granted about having a book out. I don't think I could ever be that jaded. I'm always excited. I'm always nervous. I'm always relieved that it's out. I'm always a little anxious about how it'll be received. Because, you know, the readers matter to me. And I'm, you know, like I said before, I'm really grateful for them. So it's... yeah, no, it's an exciting day. It's kind of a crazy day, crazy week. It's you know, soon enough all the tour stuff is over and then you're back in the chair at home typing.
You're back in your pajamas
so
by yourself.
That's right. I'm back in sweatpants and, you know, in a ball cap writing and not having to put a face out to the public. But it's hugely exciting. That'll never get old. This is book number 17. It'll never get old for me.
That's good. I mean, because that keeps it fresh. That keeps you exciting, and you can hear it when you're interviewing. Because I think that some authors, they've been doing this for so long, even their interviews just become stale and the same over and over again. And you're just, you know, you kind of want to get them off the phone. And I get that a lot. You know, I'm gonna be honest. There's some people that I won't interview again because and they're best-selling authors. And I'm like, yeah, but you're so freaking boring. I just can't do it anymore. I'm an honest person, and people sometimes don't like it, but I'll tell it as it is. That's just the way I feel. So.
No, I'm old. I mean, you've worked on it so long.
Yeah.
That it's, you know, and now you can't fix it anymore. You can't change it anymore. And now it has to go out there and live and die on its own. And some people will like it and some people won't. And that's fine. You're already working on the next. But I feel like I learn things on tour. I learn from what readers say to me, positive or negative. You know, that is not something that you always hear, even with people emailing you or contacting you on social media. It's a different thing to have a face-to-face contact, you know, with a reader. That's, you know, we're lucky to be able to have that. So,
well, I'll tell you, Jeff, we want to thank you so much for coming on. It has been fabulous. I mean, 25 minutes has just blown by. Of course, everybody can go to jeffabbott.com. For more information, we're going to, you know, they can hear you again if they want to check you out. And, you know, you're going to be doing something a couple days from now over with tomorrow, I guess, with Libby Hohman on her show. So that's going to be good. So hopefully I was as exciting as she's going to be, and you have just as much fun.
Oh, it's always so great to talk to you, John. Thank you so much for having me on today.
Hey, thank you. You have a great one, and congratulations. Enjoy. Looking forward to seeing the next one, and keep us up to date, and let's keep in touch.
Thanks so much, John. I will. Take care.
All right, bye-bye.
All right.
So, again, everybody, that is best-selling author Jeff Abbott. The book is called The First Order. It is the next book in the Sam Capra series. Make sure you check that out. Go to jeffabbott.com. For more information on, not this series, but the other stuff that, like he said, Grand Central has now bought, and all his stuff has been reissued, so it's a great time to check out stuff. If you don't know Jeff's work and check it out, you got a nice library to go choose from to go see his stuff. And again, we want to thank Alan Jacobson and Lee Adams for being on the show. It's a great way to kick off 2016. We want to thank you all for joining us here. We look forward to having a great 2016 season, of course, with Crime and Science Radio next Saturday. Beyond the Cover is going to be up on Monday. We're going to be you're going to be hearing interviews by Craig Johnson and Robert Crace that Jeff did. And then we'll be back the week after that, Martin Luther King Day. We're going to have our first live show for Beyond the Cover. And the Story Blender will be out on next Friday. So a lot of things going on. We're looking to do a new show that will be taking you back to like the 1940s with Suspense Radio. We are working on putting together a series that you'll be able to hear kind of old-time radio, those types of things that you'll be able to maybe follow, something a little different, just to, you know, just a little bit more entertainment, just to have something other than, all the stuff that we kind of have on TV now, which, we're just trying to see if we can expand and have a little bit more fun. So we want to thank you all for listening and joining us. Again, Happy New Year, everybody. Have a great one. You can always email us, editor@suspensemagazine.com. So until next time, keep reading.